This Journey to a Dream podcast is brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance. Hello and welcome to this episode of Journey to a Dream. Normally, in the introduction, I try and encapsulate something about the guest, tell you a little bit about them before they introduce themselves further. I honestly don't know what to say about today's guest, and we did jokingly say after we'd finished the recording, if you want something doing, ask a busy person.
I'm Linda Alton Heath, and I am part of the Andrews Racing Association here on the Isle of Man, and I'm now the chairman of the club, which I was voted in a couple of weeks ago.
Well, Linda, we'll talk much more about the association a little bit later, but it's fair to say you have a background that is steeped in motorcycling. Tell us how it all started.
I think probably 6 weeks old when my parents took me to my first motocross in Dublin. So I was born in Dublin. I'm Irish. And back in the, I won't say when it was, but quite a while ago. Yeah, my dad was the president of the Motorcycle Union of Ireland, which is the kind of the Irish version of the ACU, which we work under here. And he was a member of the FIM jury. So he travelled around Europe to motocross and road racing. And when I was a child, and we obviously went with him, and he worked quite closely with the team at Mondello as well in Ireland. So yeah, that's my childhood.
And what do you remember about that time travelling around?
Oh gosh, probably my most earliest memory was in the back of a car doing rider recovery at a road race in Ireland called Four, and where we had to go pick up a sidecar and push the sidecar back with the front of the car, and I'm like sitting in the car with my dad, like no health and safety, like fine for the kids to be in the car. But yeah, four road races and Joey Dunlop being in my grandma's kitchen, having his leathers duct taped back together because he had scrutineering the next day at Mondello. And my dad's trying to make sure that he could get through scrutineering. My dad introduced us to an amazing world of bike racing, and I'm very proud of what I've done. And I wish he was here to see it, so I know he'd be very proud of me.
And your mum had racing in her family as well?
Yeah, so my mum had five brothers. Four of them either raced or had bikes as well. And my cousin races superbikes in Australia now as well. He's out there. So yeah, mum's family are into bikes as well. My mum didn't like it quite as much. She kind of wasn't the typical pushy motocross mum like I became over the years. But no, mum kind of stayed in the background a little bit. But yeah, we were really involved, myself and my brother.
And at what point did you decide that maybe you wanted to try it yourself?
Well, when I was six, my Christmas present was a Malaguti 50. And I remember my crash helmet was too big, and my grandma had to crochet me a little skull cap. It's so embarrassing when I look at the pictures now.
You have to share that one with us.
So this crash helmet with this little crocheted skull cap underneath. But yeah, that I remember racing at a track called Mosny just outside Dublin. And on my Malaguti, and then I had a YZ80, had a Suzuki, went up to hundreds I think, and then I stopped after that. We moved to the Isle of Man in 1986, but yeah, for all of those childhood years in Ireland, it was all road racing and motocross. My dad was a timekeeper and lap scorer as well, so he most Sundays, Saturdays and Sundays, we were at a motocross event.
And you mentioned your brother as well, so he was into it too?
Yes, and my brother did trials. I'll talk a little bit about what I did later in life with him as well. So we got into sidecars. My brother was my driver. So it was at my dad's garage. My gran's house was next to it, and we were just in the fields all the time, every day after school.
So presumably, obviously, you were bought that present at the age of six. So your parents, quite encouraging. You said your mum maybe not as pushy. Did she have some reservations, do you think?
No, she was always keen on us doing what we wanted to do, and bikes were kind of what our family did. But it didn't matter to my mum. She knew I was going to be in the fields on the bikes anyway. So.
And then as you got older, sort of through teenage years, it was still something you wanted to do?
Oh gosh, moved to the Isle of Man, 1986. Like the Isle of Man back then, it was the Lido, it was the Hawaiian bar, it was just the best thing my parents could have possibly done for me and my brother. We moved from the middle of nowhere in Ireland, I literally lived in a field, to Harrisbrom. We had a hotel, so it was amazing. And years of just being around the TT again, and we'd always come over. A lot of my family live in Peel. My mum's brother moved there, two brothers moved there, and a lot of my cousins are in Peel as well, so kind of a bit of a Peelian at heart. That moving here in 86 time, and yeah, Isle of Man was just absolutely like bouncing.
I guess for somebody like you, this was the mecca of motorcycling.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we had, my mum had a choice really coming here. Like my dad, they decided they were selling their business in Ireland and mum was like, oh, I think I want a pub, and we were going to move to Peel, and then it was, now we'll get a hotel, and it was always going to be the Isle of Man. It couldn't have been anywhere else.
So how did you progress with your racing then?
So for quite a few years then, teenage years and going out, didn't really do too much. It's 92-ish. My brother and I started doing sidecar trials. So he'd been doing solo trials for many years and he had a bit of problems with carpal tunnel with arm pump, and someone said to him, oh, try a sidecar, it might not be so bad on your arms. So he said to me, oh, do you want to do sidecars? I was like, yeah, great. Sidecars within our history in Ireland as well. So we got a beater, we had a Rushton chair put on it, and that was the era of like Bruce Rushton, Robin Luscombe era for trials. Like it was tough going then. We rode a couple of years in the Isle of Man, Adrian Beale as well. Like the competition here was really good. I've done 2-day trial 3 or 4 times. We did British Championship for 3 years, then got sponsored by Aprilia. So I was this little petite, I used to be petite, blonde thing, front cover of Motorcycle News and Trials and Motocross News, and it was always Alton Towers, like it couldn't have been anything else. Got sponsored by Aprilia by Malcolm Rathmull, and it was a van and clothes and a bike, and it was like, oh my gosh. And it was just, yeah, the best few years riding for them. I remember being at the British Experts Trial down south of England somewhere, and we were in a section. It was okay, it wasn't too bad, but I remember like just corner of my eye I caught somebody on a solo bike stop and watch us, and we finished the section, I kind of turned to see who it was, and it was Steve Saunders, and I was like, oh my god, Steve Saunders has just stopped and watched me do a section. It was, yeah, you've got heroes kind of in your past life and then they come into your like everyday life. Yeah, that was a memory.
Linda, we're seeing many more women coming through the motorcycling world now. There's still not as many as men, and I wonder from your point of view what that experience was like. Were you aware of being a woman in what might have been perceived as a man's world?
Yeah, especially as like at the time being front cover of Motorcycle News. Great. I shouldn't have been front cover because we didn't win that day. Somebody else did. But because I was a girl and it was a little bit different, there was Jill Morwood was riding as well. And we did get a little bit more press. And at the time it was great and we enjoyed it. But yeah, there was probably better riders out there, but we did get the attention. And even now, there's some really amazing women in motorsport. When you look at the role models that are out there, and not just the riders, like when people like Faye Ho come and put money in and can still be classy and just be the person that she wants to be, and she's got her team, she's got Peter. Yeah, it's nice to see that now. But when even closer to home, like in the Isle of Man, we have a chief marshal at Cherby, Jo Warriner. Jo's come through the Isle of Man, she's a Manxie. She's out there with the boys and she knows what she's doing, that girl. Like she came to our AGM a couple of weeks ago and the boys were querying something about Triumphs and British Superbikes, and Jo's on it. So yeah, it's great to see.
So you went through that stage then, you were on that front cover, which must have been a very proud moment. Have you still got that front cover?
Yeah, my dad kept scrapbooks of everything. Oh my gosh, from Malaguti days right up until my brother was doing the Manx Grand Prix. Yeah, he had everything. So we did a bit of sidecar motocross as well. Gosh, we had a 500 EML motocross outfit. There used to be quite a lot of grass track racing on the Isle of Man, so we got involved in that as well. And I remember probably not my worst crash, but the one I remember the most was I had a tyre mark bruise right up my thigh, and it was compliments of Robbie Black. We crashed at Johnny Watson's Lane we were racing. I remember coming home and it was like, I've never been that black and blue in my life. But that was, yeah, sidecar grass track racing as well.
You mentioned that wasn't your worst crash. I don't want to bring back bad memories, but what was the worst one?
I've got 4 crowns on my teeth. So we were doing a bit of a little rock step. It wasn't too much really. And it was at the Yorkshire 2-day trial. Just as we tried to get drive to get a little kicker at the bottom of the step for the back wheel. Just as we were trying to get that, we lost drive going into it. But the bike and my brother stopped, but I kept going. I face planted some rocks. I'd had problems with my teeth from motocross years ago, but yeah, I properly took my teeth out in that one.
Oh my gosh, Linda, I'm literally wincing. And I think that's what some people who haven't grown up with this passion find it really difficult to understand. Hurt yourself once, okay, do it twice, 3-4 times, multiple times. Why do you keep going back?
Probably a bit like they say with childbirth, you forget the pain. You just got to get back on the bike, and you've got a championship that you're competing in, and you've got some sponsors. Or like I had my brother as was my driver, so it's like, right, get your mouth sorted out, get your teeth fixed. We've got another rounder on the boat like in 2 weeks time to go back again. The boys are the same now, they just do it. Marcus Simpson recently, he came off at Cookstown, and he had, it was only like, he said his slowest crash 20 miles an hour, but he damaged his spleen. And like Marcus's sole focus was how could he get to the start line at the TT? It wasn't like, I need to be better. It was, how can I be better enough to go racing? And obviously ACU and the doctors step in and they didn't let him race at the TT. He went to the Manx Grand Prix, which was fabulous. But yeah, you just do it. You just got to be back out on the bike.
I think when you see somebody physically being lifted onto a bike because they've had broken ankles in recent weeks, you get a sense of just what drive there is.
You can't explain it. It's something inside you with bikes that it's everything that you do. When my ex-husband was racing, we've not paid our mortgage because he needed a quick shifter. Or you come out of TT and you've got a $5,000 tyre bill and you're like, right, what's not getting paid so we can keep Pirelli or Dunlop happy so we can then get tyres for British Superbikes. So yeah, you kind of just do it.
So you and your brother were racing together. What happened next? Where did you want to take that?
Yeah, so we were doing Cycle Trial, Cycle Motocross, and then there was another couple on the Isle of Man, Carl and Mandy Ellison, and Carl was Dave Molyneux's road race passenger, and Carl and Mandy started doing sidecar trials. We got really friendly with them. We did some holidays. We kind of went with Steve Colley around Europe to some trials and things. And my brother and I decided we were going to do a bit of road racing. So we went up to Derby, and Malcolm and Paul Farragher brought their bike up, and we had a little go in it. And I was still a bit injured from I'd hurt my knee. Different crash. I think it was British Expert. I'd hurt my knee, so I was still a little bit sore. And it didn't. We liked it. We weren't good. We were okay. And I was like, I'm not sure about this. So road racing wasn't our thing. Like, we had a go, just wasn't for us. And then my brother decided he was going to go solo road racing. So that was his plan then. So I took a bit of a step back from actually competing and helped him with his racing career.
How did you feel about him making that decision?
To go without me. Sidecar road racing, I loved it, but I knew we weren't going to be who we were in sidecar trials. And probably at that time, I was getting married, and it was kind of the right time to have a little bit of a break. He went solo road racing. I helped him run the team. My dad, we bought a van, and we travelled together. So that's how I met my ex-husband, Chris Heath. I met him at Pembrey when my brother was racing there. That was 96-ish, 97, yeah. Married 98, had our daughter in 99. So the timing was good to have a little bit of a break.
We haven't mentioned your brother's name, actually.
Rob Alton. He's actually a mechanic for the Prez racing team. He was Paul Jordan's mechanic, and when Paul was having his victories at the TT.
And in terms of what it was like for you, seeing it from the other side, I guess, supporting him, what do you remember about that?
I remember Steve Plater winning Shell Green Jackets. I remember standing on the grid at Mallory with him. It was great to support him, and because it was my brother as well. I think you see it with the Crows. There's just something when you compete with your brother or when you're in a team with them that there's unspoken things that just happen. You just know your driver or you know your rider so well that it just works.
So you met your ex-husband. Yep. Do you think there was ever any question that you were going to marry a racer?
Definitely not a racer chaser, but I think when you're in that world, they're the only people you know. And like, could I go out for a drink with someone who like talked about football? Like, what would we talk about? Like, if I tried to explain to him like how you do a pit stop at the TT, and they're like, yeah, that's really interesting, let's go and watch however many men it is run round after a ball, like, I couldn't do it.
Early days of marriage, you have your daughter. I mean, how involved were you at that time when you had so much else going on?
Yes, that's when I became very involved in the organisation of a team. So Chris rode, we had our own team, but he did end up riding for Sean Muir, SMR, who's now the BMW World Superbike team. And he rode for Paul Bird on the Vimto bikes. We had a little bit of help with Honda, and that's when I first met Neil Tuxworth on the Honda side of things, which I kind of fell into again later. And then 2009, Chris got the opportunity to ride in the first electric race at the TT. So we got heavily involved with an American team at that point, and we went away testing, and there was lots going on. And he actually won that first electric race. A little bit of controversy at the podium. He was actually denied the win. It actually flashed up on his screen that he'd been disqualified from the race just as they were going to the podium. It all got resolved in the end, but he never actually got his podium. So we had a little fake podium a couple of days later up at the grandstand. But yeah, he got the win, which opened up a whole world of post-TT winners invitations. And we went to Goodwood, and it was, yeah, Festival of Speed was amazing. He'd done British Superbikes as well, so he'd done well there. So running a team with him, I saw the other side of it. I could do the part of the mechanical side of it. I was managing everything apart from the handlebars, really.
And how did you find not being physically on a machine?
So we still had motocross bikes, although I wasn't competing. My daughter at this point, Sophie, she was doing motocross. We had a practice track. John Quillish, who's our president at ARA, he's got a farm up at Balgan, and we had a little motocross track up there. So we were always out on the bike. So it was either Chris racing or Sophie starting to compete then as well.
And you mentioned earlier that your mum wasn't pushy. Does that mean you were a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I was motocross mum. I was there on the sideline, fist
shaking. I didn't know
shaking.
This was a thing.
Oh. Yeah, motocross mums. Oh, we're a fabulous breed. It's like the win always counts. But there was Sophie was racing, and there was Tanya Denter and Keely Shannon were the kind of the girls doing it, and us little group of mums. It was Lynn and was there as well on the sideline when Keely and Sophie were racing. And we started going away to the UK. The girls did some racing in the girls' national championship. So I think there's not many forms of motorsport where there is a separate girls event, and in the UK they had the girls nationals, and Tanya was really, really good. We miss Tanya a lot, and Keely and Sophie were off racing as well. And Sophie had a bit of a bad crash when she was 12 at Finningley. She'd hurt her arm, her leg. She was bashed up, she was bruised, she was a couple of weeks off school for that one. And that was Sophie's point of thinking, yeah, Mum, I think I might just give it a little break. Like, 12-year-old girl, she was on 85s then, big wheel 85s. And she was racing with, like, Ryan and Jamie Kringle, Jed Etchells. Like, look at Jed now. He's out there winning world events. And it was tough for her. Unfortunately, she was sitting in the lounge in our house. We lived in Baldrine, and across the field was a horse. And she saw this horse, and she's like, Mum, I think I want to try horse riding. I don't do horses. They have no handlebars and no engine. You can't just turn them off. So we went and we had a look at this horse, and I thought, okay, we'll get her into horse riding. I wanted a CB500, and we accidentally bought a super bike. So we bought this horse called Garfield, who we still have now. And yeah, I'd bought a super bike without even knowing what that meant for a horse. Next thing I had to do my HGV, and I had a horse box, and we were competing, and this child of mine, who seemed to be really good at motocross, was suddenly really good at horse riding as well. And it's a fabulous world for her. She absolutely loved it, and I do think that her motocross years helped her with the horse riding. It's that determination and that kind of can-do attitude as well. So yeah, we ended up horse riding for a few years.
You became horse mum.
I was much better at being a motocross mum than a horse mum. I would shout with Sophie to go faster at motocross. I'll be up at Ballygarrigan and I'll be there giving it loads. I go to like a jump off at Comrennie, and I don't breathe while she's doing the jump off, because I just don't understand the horse or the world that it is. Yeah, motocross was much safer for me. I was much happier when she was doing motocross.
So you've got all that going on, but presumably you've still got one foot in the motorcycle world as well.
Yeah, kind of. It was a strange one. I came to a point in my life where I was getting divorced, and Sophie had stopped motocross. Chris wasn't racing, and our divorce was happening. And then I found myself questioning who I was as a woman in motorsport. And it's a tough one. It happens a lot of the wives in the paddock, and that you're very involved and you're running a team with your husband, or you're helping, you know what you're doing. And then you become like the spare female. Was I still welcome in the paddock? Now I was somebody's ex. Would I be a racer chaser? I didn't want to be. Would I be perceived as that? And it was, could I validate my presence, or would I kind of get a little bit of imposter syndrome, and should I be here? But then I came through that amazingly. Three people got me back into the world that I'm in now, and that was Sandrina Teith from the Craigna Bar, most famous pub in racing, Kev Kringle, Ryan and Jamie's dad. Kev was a great support to me, and also Klaas Klaffenbach, Claffy, three times TT winner, Claffy Honda. So Claffy had been there and done it with race teams. Those three people, each in their own way, kind of got me back into it. And it was Kev in, I think it was 2016, is when I really got back into racing, and he was running KPC racing team, and Cy Fulton, who'd won the Meister Grand Prix a number of years ago. We had Cy riding the bike, and Cy went and rode 600s at TT, and I was kind of helping Kev set everything up, helping Cy with managing children, life, bikes, sponsors, all of that. He did the 700 as well that year. And then Sandrina had me helping out at the Craig at TT. Klaus was part of the Honda team. So Klaus ran all of the hospitality side of it for Honda Motors Europe and for BSB, for Honda UK and Honda Roads. I ended up working with the team manager of Honda, Johnny 12 Trees, at World Endurance. So off I went, little old me, with all my Honda Honda kit on in my little suitcase and off to Le Mans to manage everything for Klaus and with regard to the non-racing side of the Honda team and all the hospitality, the sponsors. That led to me working with Honda France and with Fujisan, who's based at Suzuka. He runs the TSR Honda France team. And my riders were like, I was working with Freddie Foray. That year for TT, we had John McGuinness and Guy Martin, Sebastian Gimbert. So yeah, some really, really good riders in our team that year with World Endurance and the Rhodes team as well. I think it's 2017 at Le Mans. I had a week where the person I had to look after was Freddie Spencer. So it's like, again, it's a bit like Steve Saunders' moment. It was like, someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and say, like, you're not meant to be with walking around with Freddie Spencer. Like, he's famous. Who are you? I remember being in the awning at Le Mans. It's crazy. I don't know if you've ever been. It's like 200,000 people. Just the noise, the passion for the French have for racing. It's insatiable. And this guy comes into the awning and he wanted to speak to Greg LeBlanc. And I was like, no, sorry. That's banter. Can't come in. And then Freddie Foray comes up and he goes, Linda, that's Jean-Michel Bayle. I was like, oh my God, I've just tried to kick Jean-Michel Bayle out of the awning. And all of that Honda life was, yeah, really down to Klaus. So I've done maybe 5 years with Klaus looking after the Honda team, British Superbikes and the world side of things. COVID stopped the world team. And then Rhodes as well. So yeah, we look after them at TT.
It's so amazing that you got that validation at the time you did, Linda, because as I'm starting to really find in this world of motor racing, people aren't very good at pushing themselves forward.
I'm even sitting here now talking about myself. I made some notes before I came out, and when I started looking at like where I've been and the people I've been with in life, I'm so lucky. And I think, yeah, as a female, it can be trickier. It's probably getting easier. As I said at the beginning, I'm now chairman of Andrea's Racing. We have had Lizzie Kinvig, clerk of the course, so TT, again, an amazing lady in motorsport. And it's people like Lizzie and Joe, our race secretaries at Andrea's. We've got Liz and Val, again, women in motorsport. Liz now helps out with the TT as well in the office, and it's pushing ourselves forward. And like I think I mentioned, imposter syndrome, I probably have it every day when I'm in the paddock and I'm telling somebody, like Matt Stevenson was racing with us at the Endurance last year, and I'm like, that's Matt Stevenson, and I'm telling him he's got to go in the stop box and do a penalty. And I'm like, who am I to tell him that?
That imposter syndrome, I think, sums it up, because anybody just talking to you for a minute can see just how skilled you are and how much you bring to this world. And it sounds like for you need that external validation. You wouldn't be pushing yourself forward. You got that in 2021 though.
Gosh, yeah. Somebody, I still don't know who, nominated me for Isle of Man Sports Administrator of the Year. So at the Isle of Man Sports Awards, I won Isle of Man Sports Administrator of the Year, and I was in total shock because, as you say, that validation, it doesn't come very often. And when it came from someone like Isle of Man Sport and winning that, yeah, really, really proud of that one. I've got the award in my office at home.
And just having that sense of how much you mean to the industry and to the people in it.
And that was part of standing up on that stage. It was my thoughts were, oh my gosh, somebody nominated me and people have voted for me and they think I'm better than the people who are organising all the other sports on the island. And it was really, really nice to receive it.
I just want to talk about something that happened just after COVID, which, as you say, just brought everything in the world to a standstill. What happened just after that? Where did you end up?
I ended up in the bizarrest place, and it came out of nowhere, really. So I've been very good friends with Harry Payne. People who know sidecars will know Harry is one of the most committed and dedicated sidecar drivers and passenger. He passengered for Dave Molyneux as well at the TT. Came out of COVID, and we hadn't been anywhere for like a year, had we, or longer. Next thing, I find myself on a flight to Gatwick, on a train to Lydon, and got picked up by Mark Wilkes's mum, Harry's passenger, and he rode at Lord of Lydon. We then jumped in Mark's car and got on a ferry to Dunkirk, drove through the night and went to Frankfurt, where Harry had been offered a wildcard ride at the World Championship in Estoril. So Harry and I picked up a bike from Steinhausen Racing. So Rolf Steinhausen, old school TT history world champion, amazing family. And Mike, his son, had offered Harry a bike to go and do the world round. So Harry and I drove to Frankfurt, picked the bike up, and then spent 3 days driving this left-hand drive Sprinter back through Germany, Belgium, through France. We stayed overnight. Well, we didn't actually sleep overnight. We stayed about 4 hours in Bordeaux in Paul Leglise's house. Paul's one of the French riders who comes to the TT. A few hours sleep at Paul's. Down through Spain into Portugal. We really needed some sleep, and we'd booked into a hotel halfway through Portugal, but we didn't realise that the time difference between Spain and Portugal changed. So we thought we had 1 hour to get to this hotel and we could just about keep our eyes open. We were living off Jelly Belly sweets and all sorts of things to try and keep driving. And yeah, a few hours sleep in there. And Portugal, Estoril. And he went and won. He hadn't ridden this bike before. And Harry won the world round at Estoril. We sat down after that. We had dinner. Harry was a vegan for that weekend. It was a really difficult weekend. I don't know why he decided he needed to be a vegan that weekend. Sat down in a meat barbecue restaurant where he had a salad after his win. And we decided we were going to set a team up. And Harry was going to do the world championship the following year. I went out, tried to find sponsors. I found a sponsor. And Harry brought a lot to the team as well. He'd had a number of years racing. He bought a F1 bike from Rob Biggs, so a long bike, that's what you need for world championship. They're all 600 engines, but long bikes and short bikes. And the sponsor bought the F2 bike from John Lowther, Scunthorpe. We went and picked that up. So we went away in Harry's little Ducato van and came back with about £120,000 worth of sidecars, one of which didn't fit in the van. So we were sat at Heysham Docks with Harry in the sidecar. So he had to ride it onto the ferry, which we got lots of looks. It was still COVID time and we had to come out into the Steam Packet car park and drive around the little loop. So I'm in the van and Harry's in front in the sidecar at 6 o'clock in the morning. So yeah, good memories. So set up the team. Harry did the TT for that team the next year and a couple of world rounds. Bad crash at Le Mans, ended up us driving up to Switzerland to have the bike fixed in about 2 days, and then back across to Assen, did the world round at Assen, did the TT. The team kind of imploded. I stepped away from the team. Harry's gone on now again with Steinhausen Racing, so he's doing the world championship with Steinhausen, and he has Kevin Russo as his passenger. So they're doing really, really well. Proud of him.
All of this, I mean, was this the day job, Linda?
No, God, I have a day job. So I managed to fit this all in around life. A career and a child as well. So, and no payment for any of this. Even when I was running the Dow 1886 team, there was no payment came to me as the team manager. We put all of the money actually into the team.
Some people will find that hard to understand.
Yeah, very much. It's the same with Andrew's Racing. Neil and I and all of the guys on the committee, there's no payment for anything that we do. Our payment really is when we look at the guys that are racing, especially like Manx Grand Prix this year, like for Andrew's Racing. And also last year, I know you said you had Dave Moffat in, but Moffat had his crash at the TT. And Moffat was man on a mission and got a number of teams entered into Manx Grand Prix. And we won, I think we won 3 trophies that year as Andrew Racing, just because our guys are so good at what they do. And it's people like Harry going out and doing world rounds, and the boys like Joe Yeardsley's just been racing in South America, and Marcus at the Manx as well. And it's Andrew's Racing have brought those guys through. We have a race school at Cherby, and I think Gary Radcliffe, Ray Knight started it, Gary Radcliffe runs it now. And it's down to those guys that we have the ability for this small island to have people out there on a national stage and riding as they do.
Remind us what the Andrews Racing Association is all about, who it's for.
It's for the boys out there who want to spend a Sunday doing what they love. So I think it was maybe 2019, end of 2019, I met Neil Champion for a coffee at the Sea Terminal, and he goes, listen, there's Andrews, I've taken on the role as chairman, I need someone to help me out a little bit. Do you fancy just coming and doing something, anything, just want to get involved? And I'd been chatting to Paul Cassidy, and he said, oh gosh, Andrew, it's not like it used to be, Joby's going down the pan, we need some people to get involved. And I thought, I've got a bit of time on my hands now, I'll see how it goes. 2023, I'm chairman of the club. We've had an amazing few years racing. I'm so proud of what we've achieved. It was Neil and I that have kind of come through the pain of it. We had a lot going on in the beginning. We really had to tread water to try and get the club back on its feet. But when Joe Yeardsley and Marcus Simpson stand on the podium with novice jackets on, both of them in the Tommy Club, and that's when Neil and I kind of sit there and go, that's why we did it.
This is an association not fueling its volunteers with money, but certainly with passion.
Oh, passion. And I think that's really, if we had to have a strapline for Andrews, it is like fueled by passion. We got through COVID. We were racing when the island was in lockdown. And it's, if we hadn't of raced then, people like Joe and Marcus wouldn't have done their race school and been in the Manx Grand Prix last year. Gary kept the race school going. It's We've got Derby Day. That came back alive as well. So we've not only got the actual ACU racing at the track, we brought Derby Day back, and that kind of landed with me last year. Like 4 weeks' notice, Neil and I took on Derby Day. And it's been great.
Do you know, Linda, sometimes I look at my diary and think I'm quite busy. I'm actually starting to feel like I've got palpitations thinking about what your life is like.
Oh, I have an office at home. I wouldn't want anybody to see it. You know, like on Friends, Monica's got that cupboard. That's my office. God, it's in work. I have a real job, and I'm so passionate about my real job, and I do have to travel quite a bit for that as well. So I was in Malta a few weeks ago, and Klaus Klaffenbach happened to be there completely by coincidence with his girlfriend for the weekend. So again, I combined real life and got to meet up with Klaus and Marianne again. But yeah, busy. We've got our annual dinner. It's on the 20th of January, so control freak here. I've got to organise that as well.
It was really interesting talking to Neil Champion, and you can listen to that podcast on the Journey to a Dream page. We were discussing whether or not people on the Isle of Man really realise just what talent there is over here.
Absolutely not. Neil came back from his podcast with you, and he was mortified that he hadn't mentioned the crows. He gave them a personal apology at the AGM because Callum was there, and he's like, I don't know how I miss them. He goes, because they're up there and they're so amazing and they're on like an international stage. Those boys are doing Worlds next year. I just forgot they were ours. And I'm like, yeah, they're definitely ours. I get the messages from them an hour before entries close saying, can they ride tomorrow? The world stage has got our riders on it. And yeah, they're amazing.
And how does it feel for you as a self-proclaimed control freak when you look up at a podium and you see your people there?
Probably for me, because I come from a sidecar background. My dad in Ireland, the championship trophy in Ireland for the sidecar passenger is the Bobby Alton Trophy. And I met Mark Gash through that and some of the Irish guys that race. And we've got some of them racing with us now from Ireland. Dave Marshall comes over and races. But when I see like Ryan and Callum, I think it was when they were in the holding pen and Callum was hugging Nick. And that brought it back to me for me. It was like, my dad's not here to see it. But like when I see those boys doing that and their dad being so proud of them, it brings it back home. It's for me, it's sidecars. But obviously the solos are fabulous as well. But the crow boys really do it.
How like your dad are you in style when it comes to things like organising and whatever? How much did you learn from him?
Oh gosh, probably work ethic. My dad was a mechanic. We had a garage in Ireland, and he was always at work. And it was when he wasn't working, it was bikes. And obviously he was president of the MCUI. And I think that's what I see. It's what you give back makes you who you are. And Andrea's racing for me, I'm really passionate about it. And sometimes I remember someone saying to me at an AGM, I won't say who it was, I know who it was. We were changing something and we put it to the floor to discuss it. And someone said to me, you don't know what it's like to have to pay for tyres and put a bike on the track. And at that point I was like, right, let me tell you what I've not paid for in life so that we could go racing. It takes a lot. And Val, our race secretary, said the other week, she said, do you know what? Her son Sean races. And she said, I thought you lot just kind of maybe the week before the event put a few forms in and then we were racing on the Sunday. She's going, I never had any clue it was like this. We ask the riders to help us at Derby as well. If they're not racing, we'll get them out doing recovery. So Marcus Simpson and Joey and McGee, they do recovery for us in the van and everything. But we had some of the unrestricted aisle boys helping us out, Blake and Tom. And I have two radios when I'm at Derby. So I have two earpieces in, one's for the track and one's for the paddock. So they'll both be going and then I'll have someone in front of me chatting as well. And they brought the radios back at the end of the day and they put them back in the race office and they were like, we can't explain what we've just heard today. Every rider should be made to have a day of listening to those earpieces to see what goes on. Blake was like, I'll never complain about waiting in the holding pen again. He goes, when I see what has to happen between the sessions with the clerk of the course doing the clear down and all the marshals calling in, and yeah, a lot goes on. It's full time. There's no end of season for us. Literally no end of season.
It's interesting because as we're speaking in the third weekish of December, it is a long, hard winter, I think, for racers because they're in the middle of nothing at the moment. But as you say, for you, I guess it just literally never stops.
Yeah, so we just had the AGM and that was about 60 people there. And Neil and I, we felt that was a good response. So you don't want too many people there because that's usually when something's not going right. People want to know the gossip of what's happening. great input. We have a fabulous bunch of lads racing now with us on CB500s, and they're bringing through a lot of younger riders as well, and people that want to get into racing but don't have huge budgets. They were bringing some ideas with regard to the newer bikes coming through and how we wanted to manage that. And then Neil and I are looking at all of that now with the race secretaries and the riders reps to see, shall we change our regs to match British Superbikes and No Limits, to allow the CBs to carry on as they are, and the Triumphs. Marcus Simpson and Ryan Kringle have got Triumphs now. They'll be BSB spec. Technically, they wouldn't be able to ride in the 600 class with us. So we'll change our regs, because these boys, we want them racing with us. So we will facilitate them coming to Derby. The dinner, Andrew's dinner on the 20th of January. If anybody wants some tickets for that, give me a shout. And that's our prize presentation. We've got Tim Johnson, MHK, coming to present our awards. Hopefully Jason Griffiths as well. 150 people at the Palace, so busy organising that.
And you were talking about some of the decisions that you're making looking ahead to the future. How does it feel having responsibility for the future of racing, essentially, over here?
I don't mind responsibility. I'll take it on the chin if I get something wrong. I'll happily push my ideas out there. I'll say sorry again if it's not right, but we have to do it. Andrew's Racing Association has been around as long as me. It started at Andrew's Airfield, now at Derby. We are why people on the Isle of Man have the Joe Yeardsley and the Marcus Simpsons and the Crows. If there wasn't Andrea's Racing, and that's the past of Andrea's Racing, the whole 50 years of it being in existence, we wouldn't be where we are now.
Have you been on a bike recently?
What was my last bike I was on? Yeah, my daughter's just got a 125 KTM. She's doing motocross again. So I've just had to buy a van again. She's just come back from uni. So yeah, we're back into owning bikes again.
Look at that. Motocross mum is happy.
Motocross, I'm very happy.
Linda, just remind people how they can find out more about the Andrews Racing Association.
So Andrews Racing, have a look at our website, andrewsracing.im. We've also got a Facebook page. Lots going on there. You will hear about some Manx Radio as well. Chris Kinley's on our committee. Kinners is fab at promoting what we do. If you see anybody on a bike, just mention Andrew's Racing and they'll hopefully tell you about it.
And just finally, what are your big dreams for 2024?
2024, chairman of the club. I'm also a probationary clerk of the course as well for the ACU. So I need to get my signatures on that so I can actually clerk. So I need to go away to the UK and clerk at a couple of events there for that to happen, to support Neil. And it'll be a good season of racing. We've got six or seven championship rounds, the endurance at the end of the year. And hopefully we'll have Marcus as a newcomer at the TT, and we'll have the Crow boys on the podium at Worlds and the TT.
Linda, please tell me you haven't got everything already wrapped for Christmas as well as all of that. I bet
did
you have.
Did a little bit of wrapping last night.
I knew it.
But accidentally sent my daughter's Christmas present, because I bought it on Amazon, to the UK, because she changed the address. So beware, any mums out there, watch when your children change the address on the Amazon account. Need to get them back.
You have to do one thing wrong. Linda, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us here.
Linda Alton-Heath. And now you know why I found it so difficult to introduce her, but glad to hear that she's back to being a motocross mum. Thank you so much for downloading this episode. And if you have a story that you'd like to tell, we'd love to hear from you. BethSB@manxradio.com is the best email address. You can find that link on the podcast page. And until next time, goodbye. This Journey to a Dream podcast has been brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance. Visit their website, kawasaki-insurance.co.uk, to find out how you can get covered.